And if you have a Bible, if you had it open at Hebrews 11, that would be a great help. There was a man in the Midwest of America who was a notorious atheist, and he didn't keep that to himself. He went around the lecture circuit pointing out the stupidities of the gospel, pointing out the foolishness of those who called themselves Christian. One day, however, he was caught up in some terrible floods, rather like the kind of floods, I suppose, we've been having in this country in recent weeks. And escaping from the flood, he was suddenly convicted of his sinfulness, and he was converted. He became a Christian. And he turned all the enthusiasm of denouncing the gospel he had had into preaching the gospel. He went around far and wide preaching the gospel and giving his testimony. And it has to be said, as the years went by, the floods became ever more dramatic, the conversion became ever more wonderful, and the story ever more spectacular. And so the apocryphal story goes, he died, and at the pearly gates, the angel who welcomed him said, "It's usual on the first night here to give your testimony." And he said, "Well, I'll tell them about the flood." And the angel said, "Yes, well, we've heard about that before, but I should warn you that Noah will be in the audience." I think when we read Hebrews 11, that is the kind of feeling that must strike us about the life of faith. Very often we think of our own feeble and faltering and fitful and erratic faith. And think of these great heroes and heroines of the faith. We can be extremely discouraged and extremely dismayed. But that's not really what this passage is about. The main point of this passage, as indeed of the whole letter, is to help discouraged Christians. This letter, this great letter to the Hebrews, probably written to Christians in Rome, probably to second and third generation Christians, because it talks in chapter 13 about remembering their leaders, those who had once led them and had now gone. So we're probably in the second and third generation. The fire had burned somewhat low. There's probably some persecution as well. There are hints of that throughout the letter. And our author is saying, don't fall out of the race. Our author is giving this picture of those who ran the race before, not in order to discourage us, not so that we can compare ourselves to them and say, my faith is never going to reach that level, but rather, he says in chapter 12, verse 3, consider him. And that's really the title, if you like, for this sermon this evening, consider him. Christian life is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And the question is, how do we last? How do we keep going? How do we reach the winning post? I'm sure we all felt last week for the athlete who failed to make the winning post in the marathon. Her despair was etched on her face, and no one could but feel sorry for her after all the training. Our author is saying, there is no danger of not reaching the finishing post because of the provision we've been given to help us there. Consider him. Sometimes when you go to some churches in England, particularly non-established churches, on the lectern or on the pulpit are written words which are invisible to everyone except the preacher. And they're the words from John 12, "Sir, we want to see Jesus." That could be written over the whole letter to the Hebrews. "Sir, we want to see Jesus." A reminder to the preacher that he's not there to peddle his own ideas, not there to give the latest theories. That's the job of preaching, to show people, to lead people to Jesus. "Sir, we want to see Jesus." And that's the great theme of this great letter. I'm almost slightly amused reading chapter 13, verse 22, where the author says, "I have written you only a short letter." I think if we had written a letter as long as the letter to the Hebrews, we'd feel we had done justice to our subject. But when you think of the greatness of this subject, Jesus Christ and the whole drama of salvation, consider him. And any letter written about that, however long or however deep, like this letter, is going to be a short letter. So we're going to look particularly at chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. The way I want us to look at it is to look at the three people, or the three groups of people. This is a very crowded scene. And we look first of all at the spectators. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, most preachers, when they see the word therefore, cannot resist the temptation to expound what has come up to it. You'll be relieved to know I'm not going to try to expound the first 11 chapters. But it is a follow-on from chapter 11, particularly with the race of faith. And the great cloud of witnesses are further referred to later on in the chapter in verse 23 as the spirits of righteous men made perfect. And of course, that cloud of witnesses has grown considerably since the author wrote. Many whom we know and love are part of that great cloud of witnesses. And the question that arises, what are they witnesses of? What are they witnesses to? Are they watching us, for example? Because the metaphor is of spectators looking at the runners as they pound along the arena. In other words, do the blessed dead know anything of the church on earth? Now, that's a great mystery, and I'm not going to try to speculate too much about it. But surely the point is that they are witnesses in the first place to the reality of the life of faith. They have reached the goal. They have won the race. And we, as we run the race, can know for certain that it's possible to make it. The word cloud is an interesting word, suggesting both vast numbers and also an essential unity, these spectators. How is the church going to end? What's going to be the end of the story of the church on earth? As we read dismal statistics of the tide going out and of the decline of Christianity throughout the Western world, not least in this land of Scotland, where the decline is devastating and terrifying. Now, the one thing we must not do is be complacent about it, and yet we mustn't become depressed by it, because we know that the end of the church's story is not to die out. The end of the church's story, as we read about in Revelation 7, is a great multitude whom no one can count before the throne of God and of the Lamb. The great cloud of witnesses of this chapter. So this great cloud of witnesses, the spectators, bear witness to the reality of the life of faith, the reality of the future world, and the reality of the invisible Lord. Now, of course, we have to live in the present world and in the visible world. You hear it, I've heard it said that some people are too heavenly minded to be of any earthly use. Have you ever in your life met anyone like that? I most certainly have not. And that is certainly not my problem. Most of us are terribly comfortable in the present world and in the present life. Our danger is almost exactly the opposite, is it not? That the present, the contemporary, the visible, all but crowd out the invisible world and the unseen Lord. Earlier on in verse 27 of chapter 11, our author has said of Moses, he persevered because he saw him who is invisible. He was not afraid of the anger of the king. There was the very visible anger of the king, the very visible splendor of the great Egyptian empire. How did Moses make it to the goal? He made it to the goal because he saw him who is invisible. And that's how you and I are going to make it to the goal as well, because of him who is invisible. And they're also witness to the importance of the scriptures. These examples are taken from the Old Testament, and probably in the later verses we read in verses 35 and following, on the period between the Testaments and the contemporary scene. It's important to read Christian history and biography, both as inspiration and warning, because when we read how others have run the race, how they have made it to the goal, that's a tremendous inspiration. How did they reach the goal? Because they considered him. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so you will not grow weary and lose heart. That's the first group of people in this crowded scene. The vast multitude already gathered before the throne of God and of the Lamb. The multitude that increases daily, hourly, as more and more of the runners reach the finishing post. And that brings us to the second group of people, who are the runners themselves. Let us run with perseverance, chapter 12, verse 1, the race marked out for us. Now, the idea here is not so much of competition as of priorities. We're not competing with each other in the race. We're not trying to see whether we can win gold medals and beat other people. The idea is of priorities. And our author says, if we're going to run with perseverance, there's two things we have to do. First thing is, verse 1, let us throw off everything that hinders. Now, these are not necessarily wrong things. Indeed, many of them are good and necessary and right things in their own place. It could be money. It could be status. It could be our job. It could be our homes, our family, anything at all which hinders us from running. Now, we're not being asked to give all these things up. What we are being asked to do is to get a true sense of priorities. Sometimes people may be asked to give all or any of these things up, but God doesn't always ask that. What the Lord does say is get them in a true perspective. If money is becoming such an obsession with me that I'm not running the race any longer, then I've got to do something about it. If my home has become an obsession, then I've got to ask myself, what have I got a home for? What am I using it for the Lord? Or am I using it just to gratify my own desires? If my job has become so overwhelming, there's no time for anything else, once again. Now we know we live in a vastly complicated world. We live in a very busy world. There's never been a time when there's been so many labour-saving devices and yet so many utterly busy and harassed people. Our author is saying, throw off everything that hinders. That's the first thing. But the second thing we must do is we must throw off the sin that so easily entangles. That's also in verse 1. The old version says, the besetting sin has become a proverbial expression. Now, what does that mean? It could mean a specific sin, which is specific to you or specific to me. We're not all tempted to the same things. We don't all react in the same way to situations. And indeed, it could be different sins at different times in our lives, which we find a great hindrance. It's often been said that up to a certain age, sex is the great temptation, and after that, money is the great temptation. Now, these are generalizations, but each of us have particular sins. But I rather think that's not what the author is referring to, although that's a true enough point in itself. I think our author is referring to something he said way back in chapter 3. In chapter 3, verse 12, he warns his readers and he warns us against a sinful, unbelieving heart which turns away from the living God. A sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God. And at that point in the book, he begins an extended comparison with the life of the church and the story of Israel's journey through the desert. That generation, that first generation, of whom only two, Joshua and Caleb, actually reached the goal. And our author is desperately afraid that that might happen with the early church. And you know, it very nearly did. Think about where the great early churches were. Places like Smyrna, places like Alexandria, and so on. Where are they now? I was hearing about somebody who did one of those package tours, the visit to the seven churches, and in Smyrna, he asked, where was the church in Smyrna that was talked about in the book of Revelation? And the guide says, we think it was over there, because that's where the mosque is. You see, these churches simply disappeared, as the Lord warned them in the book of Revelation, I will come and remove the candlestick. It's always dangerous to imagine that it's impossible to fall away. I was brought up on the east coast of Fife, a little fishing village called St. Monans. Many years ago, almost 100 years ago, there was a great revival there, as there was in most of the fishing ports up and down the east coast, right down from Lowestoft in the south, right up round the coast of Fife, round the Buchan coast, and he's right up to the Orkney and Shetland Islands. And my grandfather was converted then as a young man, and many of his generation. And this was largely through the instrument God used as a man called Jock Troop, who was a fisherman turned evangelist. And he preached powerfully up and down these fishing ports. And a real God was done. One of the results of that work of God was the establishing of many flourishing Christian churches. When I was a boy, they were still there. Now, most of them have gone. They've become garages, they've become other premises. One or two of them remain. But the life has gone, and over them you could write the words of 1 Samuel Ichabod, "Where has the glory gone?" You see, it's important that we don't live in an imagined past. God is always leading us onward and forwards and upwards. Yeah, I think the problem is, when we begin the Christian life, we often think it's going to be easy. Because when we come to Christ, very often, particularly if we're young, he's very gracious to us. And he allows us to enjoy a period which is almost trouble-free. And then, of course, inevitably, the troubles come. Some troubles that are just the ordinary troubles of being human. Other troubles which are troubles because we are Christian. And we swing to the opposite extreme, and we start saying it's impossible. Our author is saying the Christian life is certainly not easy, nor is it impossible. It's difficult, it's tough. But we can make it. What does he say? Consider him. He is there at the finishing post. Consider him. So we've looked at the spectators. We've looked at the runners. And now finally, let's look at the author and perfecter of our faith himself. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. This is his human name, Jesus. Nowhere in the New Testament is the divinity of Jesus and his equality with God more strongly emphasized than in the letter to the Hebrews, particularly in chapter 1. But having established that, our author now uses his human name, the name that reminds us that not only is he one with God, he is one of us, and that he ran the race himself. As the old Scottish paraphrase of this passage says, "Behold a witness nobler still, who trod affliction's path, Jesus, at once the finisher, author of our faith." Not only is he at the goal, but he's alongside to help. Now remember the situation these early Christians were in. It's interesting, many of the Roman and Greek authors called the early Christians atheists, because they didn't seem to have any of the external trappings of religion. They didn't seem to have any temples. They didn't seem to have any priests. They didn't seem to have any sacrifices. Indeed, this was said also at a much later stage when Archbishop Laud's was sent by Charles I to Scotland. Now, he didn't find in the Scottish churches the splendour and the pomp and the circumstance he was accustomed to. And he wrote this, "The benighted people appear to have no religion," meaning that they had none of the many externals that he thought was necessary. That's why our author continually insists that we do have these things. We have a sacrifice, we have an altar, and above all, we have a great high priest who has gone into heaven, Jesus the Son of God. But it's so difficult in a world where there are so many pressures not to be seduced by the visible and the external. That's why our author says, if you're not going to be seduced by the visible and the external, you must look upwards. Fix our eyes. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus. It's an unusual word, this. It literally says, let us look away from towards Jesus. And the obvious question is, who or what is the author saying we must look away from? Now, some have argued that this means look away from the hindrances, the things that hinder, the sin which entangles. Now that's true enough, but that'd be a rather trite and obvious thing to say. He's already told us to throw these aside. So he's hardly going to say that simply in other words again. I want to suggest to you he's saying something rather different. I think he's saying look away from the great cloud of witnesses themselves. He's saying, be inspired by them, be challenged by them, but don't run the race continually looking over your shoulder to them. That illustration I mentioned earlier on about the dangers of trying to live on a past experience and on past glories. We will not run well if we keep on looking at the spectators. Just be inspired by them, but not try to imitate them in the wrong way. He doesn't say, let us fix our eyes on Moses, who endured the cross and sat down on the right hand of God. Let us fix our eyes on Abraham. They are only runners, but here we have one who is, first of all, the author of our faith. Author in the sense that he offered the perfect sacrifice to God, which made it possible for us to run the race at all. And author in the sense that it was he, by his Spirit, who planted faith in our hearts. And he is the perfecter. In other words, he will bring it to fruition. There is nothing that's made clearer over and over again in the New Testament than that Jesus Christ will lose none of his people. There is no possibility of him losing any of his people because he will bring their faith to perfection. And we're told he sat down. Now that's rather like that phrase at the beginning of our Bibles that when creation was completed, God rested. That didn't mean God did nothing thereafter, or that Jesus does nothing except sit down. It rather suggests the completion of one stage of the work, brevity of the trial, and the permanence of the glory. So he says, look away from them, look towards Jesus. Read your Christian biography, be inspired by it, and then look away. It's always a danger to read Christian biography and then try to imitate people in them, because if we do that, all we do is imitate their mannerisms. When I remember when I began my ministry, I used to read all kinds of exciting books about revivals and so on. I made a big mistake. And the mistake I made was I would read them and discover how long the person had been in the place before revival began. And maybe I would read the great work of David Watson in York and discover it was 18 months before anything very wonderful happened. And I thought, oh well, I've only been here 12 months. I've only another 6 months to wait. Then, of course, the 18 months passed and still nothing happened. You see the danger. It doesn't mean that we're not to be inspired. It doesn't mean that God can't work. It means that God has his own unique work to do in people in different ways and at different times. So fix your eyes on Jesus. Turn your eyes away from the witnesses and look to him. And consider him. Calculate, estimate. Sit down and think to yourself, what was it like for Jesus as he ran the race? In his earthly life, Jesus was not shielded from the temptations, from the trials. Didn't at all live a life like the Queen. In some ways it must be wonderful to be the Queen, never having to stand in a queue, never having to decide what you're going to wear and so on. In other ways it must be awful. But Jesus' earthly life was not in the least like that. It was exactly like our earthly life. Indeed, our author says, every respect he was tempted like us, except that he did not sin. He had as the great Christmas carol says, he was little, weak, and helpless. Tears and smiles like us he knew. And he endured such opposition. I think the old word is better here. The word here is actually contradiction. Particularly speaking, not so much about the cross, but about the verbal position. Now, that's certainly true in our world today. The media is virtually uniformly hostile to the gospel. Crosses political boundaries, and on television and in newspapers, the media is always on the side of a godless lifestyle. We know what it is to have contradiction. And we must stand up to it. We must face up to it. We must consider him. The spectators, they have made it. They are at the goal and their number grows day by day. Runners, we are encouraged to lay aside what hinders and what holds us up and instead to run with perseverance. And finally, the author and perfecter. I don't know the circumstances of people here. But whatever your circumstances are, as our author is saying to us, if you've just begun the Christian faith, if you've a new found faith, then consider him. If you're growing old and rather tired and weary with the Christian race, then consider him. If you've got tough decisions to make and don't know which way to turn, consider him. If you're facing new opportunities and want to make the best of them, then consider him. And as you work together as a church, if you go ahead to new outreach and to new ways of reaching the people of this community, then, my brothers and sisters, consider him. Let's pray. God, our Father, we praise you for the great cloud of witnesses, for those who have run the race, have kept the faith, and have reached the goal. And we pray now for ourselves, who feebly struggle while they in glory shine. Help us indeed to fix our eyes on Jesus, to consider him, and by his grace and by his mercy, to keep persevering until the race is won. We ask this in his name. Amen.